There we go. Does everyone have a handout? There's still a few. The handout tonight is different, of course, as you can see from last week. Does anyone need some back time? Last week's? Okay. The one I gave out last week. Oh, we've got enough. He's got some from last week. Okay. No, I think they're all done. There's a couple of copies. Last week I gave you some handout, which was some scientific stuff. Okay. About the Neanderthals particularly, because, and when I give you something like this, I want you to realize that the dates on these things are not accurate. They're dates according to the evolutionists, and they slew that in all sorts of directions to suit their own ideas. But the facts of the matter are there were two kinds of people. Their skeletal remains show they were different in appearance. And we talked last week how that could correspond to the descendants of Seth, who are called the children of God, and the descendants of Cain, who were the children of men. And the descendants of Cain were very violent. They were hunters. They didn't farm. They couldn't farm because God had put a curse on Cain and his descendants, apparently, such that they couldn't farm. So they depended upon Seth's descendants for their vegetable groceries. And that may be about the only thing that allowed some of them to live down to the time of the flood. And we'll see a verse tonight that suggests that God gave them some special protection as his children. So anyway, just a warning when you read in here that they died out in 28,000 B.C., that's somebody's estimate based upon the layer of the earth in which the skeleton was found. And the ages of the layers of the earth was determined before there was C-14 dating or any of those things over 100 years ago. So that evidence about time, we can talk about that sometime. The estimates of people who study the Bible is wrong too, because that second genealogy given in the 10th chapter of Genesis is, if you put that one together, you see that it makes everybody in that list contemporaries, and it doesn't progress as it should in time. And we'll talk about that some further at another time. But just realize that the time stated in these articles that the scientists give us are usually much more ancient because they want more time for evolution to occur. Now tonight I've given you a different kind of a handout, and it summarizes on one side chapters 6 and 7. We talked about chapter 6 last time, and tonight we're going to talk about 7 and some of 8, parts of 6, 7, and 8. So This just gives you a kind of a synopsis of my view about how we're looking at the progression of human history from the sending forth of Adam, that first rider on a horse, and then the other three riders who were Satan trying to oppose Adam's influence in the world. Okay, do we still have handouts to give out? We're running short. Well, I think almost everybody's here that's going to be here. Maybe you can share with someone nearby. So you can read that, and if you don't get what we're talking about here, maybe when you read this, a synopsis, it'll give you an idea of where we're going anyway. And I'll try to do that periodically and catch us up. So what happens historically after Adam goes out? He has 10 generations of descendants, and Cain has 9 or 10, and there's this battle between the good guys and the bad guys. The bad guys don't follow any of the rules. And there was this business about vengeance. As we finished the lesson last week, the fact that the righteous dead were asking God about vengeance. And it comes as a surprise to some people that there was a judgment at the end of the first world. Peter talks about the world that then was, that was overflowed with water, and the world that now is, which will be destroyed how? By fire, not by water. And so there are two different worlds. And that first world, when it ended, there was a judgment. And the righteous will see them in tonight's lesson. Now let me get our PowerPoint working here. Now there are a series of seven seals on the scroll that the Lamb is opening one at a time as the history progresses. Apparently the seals are buried within the scroll. I saw something on the TV, even today they were talking about the seven devastations of the apocalypse or something like that. And they kept showing the scroll with seven seals down the outside of it. I don't think that's the case at all. These other seals are buried within it, so you can unroll it a little bit. You hit a seal, you have to break that seal to get deeper into the scroll. And so the scroll goes through the seven seals, and that's it. That ends the first world. And so we'll see that opening of the seventh seal, and then we start to a different series of events in the world after the flood. So this is still before the flood. I watched as he opened the sixth seal. Who's he? Who's able to open those seals? Christ, the Lamb. And it comes as something of a surprise that he was known by the people in the first world. I mean, you go back, we'll look at a verse in a minute. You go back to the discussion about the Lamb in chapter 6 or chapter 5. And you see that he's going to be the Savior of all the world, all of the nations, all of the people, all of the languages. It's all listed there. So he had some sort of interaction with the people of the first world. So he opened the sixth seal, and there was a great earthquake. And this is the beginning of a series of events that results in the flood. The sun turned black, so something was obscuring the atmosphere so that you couldn't see the sun. Like sackcloth made of goat hair. He's going to talk about terms that fit the people that he's talking to, of course, and so it doesn't look very scientific sometimes, but when you look at what he's saying, you can kind of see what's happening. The sun is obliterated somehow by something in the atmosphere. The whole moon turned blood red. That could either be an eclipse, but it's probably soot and ash in the air. And the stars fell. And stars in the sky fell to the earth. Now, if you were an ancient without very much scientific knowledge, and the stars start falling, not just an occasional shooting star, but we're talking about thousands of them per minute, that would be pretty scary, wouldn't it? And actually, that happened in recent history. We had a star fall like that back in the 60s. Did any of you wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning to see that particular one? It was pretty spectacular. Dozens of stars all at the same time, but not like this. Stars in the sky fell to earth as late figs drop from a fig tree when shaken by a strong wind. So there's his analogy. Late figs are overripe, aren't they? They've been hanging on the tree, and you shake the tree and they all fall off. The sky receded like a scroll rolling up, and every mountain and island was removed from its place. So something is shaking the earth, and mountains and islands are affected, and the sun and the moon are obscured. And the key here is this business of the stars in the sky having a star fall. Let me show you a picture that was painted in the Middle Ages, showing one that occurred apparently from an eyewitness. And you get an idea of what we're talking about here. This isn't an ordinary night of searching for shooting stars. You get out in some of these nights where they announce on the weather that they're going to have a see shooting stars tonight, and if you see one a minute, it's pretty good, and you got to be looking in the right place to see it because it happens very quickly. But here we have constantly stars falling, and that happens occasionally. And apparently it happened here, and what it indicates is that the orbit of the Earth around the sun, which goes circular around the sun at the center, passes through the tail of a comet. Now, the comet is that point at the lower right-hand corner that's called the coma, or the head of the comet, and it's spewing stuff off into space as it travels in toward the sun on an elliptical orbit. And so if the Earth passes through that tail of the comet fairly close, within a million miles or so, that doesn't seem close to us, but in astronomical terms, it's pretty close, then you'll get a star fall. So there was a comet that came by, a very large comet, apparently, and caused the earthquake. Now God could cause the earthquake without any help at all, of course. But we seem to be describing a natural series of events, and we'll see that God is involved in manipulating the natural events in just a moment. So here's a comet. And in my book that I wrote about the Great Flood, there are two sources of the water for the flood. Do you remember what they are? One, it says, the windows of heaven were opened. And the other was the fountains of the great deep. And those are both visible in these passages. The fountains of the great deep are not water springs. They're in the oceans, volcanoes that suddenly burst open and spew things into the atmosphere. And that's probably what obscured the sun and the moon, was the material that these huge volcanoes were spewing out, super volcanoes really, and then the fountains or the windows of heaven would be all of the ice and snow released by the comet. Now it didn't just pass through the tail of the comet, but the comet apparently orbited the Earth, came very close, and may have disintegrated in above the atmosphere of the Earth and dumped all of its water, frozen water, into the atmosphere, and that's the windows of heaven. So there was a tremendous amount of water from a very large comet. Now you can kind of imagine the effect of something like this on the people that were living in. Now remember the other thing we talked about, they're living in a single continent called Pangaea. This is on one side of the Earth is this land. And it's the sum of all of our continents today, but they're all crammed in together as a single continent. And so they live in a world where there's no clouds, there's no rain. The sun comes up, goes down every day. The world is continuously warm. There's no summer and winter. All of these things were added, and God talked about that to Noah in the 9th chapter of Genesis. All of these things were added into the world's meteorology after the flood. So, sun comes up, goes down, day after day after day, you don't see anything. Suddenly you pick up a star coming in that they hadn't seen before, and it gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger as it approaches the Earth. And then all of these things happen. You have an earthquake, and you've got all this soot and stuff in the air, and then you've got the clouds. It says the clouds, the sky rolled up like a scroll. Well, the clouds rolled in, and it began to rain, heavily rain. And it rained for how long? 40 days. That would do away with our drought, wouldn't it, if we had a 40-day rain. But it would do more than that, of course. So I think that paragraph that's grayed out here that we've already talked about is a description of the flood. And what we have in verses 15 to 17 amplifies that. The kings of the earth, the princes, the generals, the rich, the mighty, and every slave and every free man. Who's left out of that list? Do you think of anybody? It didn't matter what you did, how strong you were, or if you were a free person or a slave of somebody else. they all head for the hills. They went into the rocks of the mountains and hid in the caves. You see the part that I have in blue there. They called on the mountains and the rocks, fall on us and hide us from the face of him who sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. These people knew about Jesus as the Lamb. And that's something of a surprise. But in the patriarchal age, see, he had been selected to be the Lamb before Adam set sail on that first horse. So, why did they go in the caves? Well, not only did all of the humans go to the mountains, but remember in the fourth of the horses that came forth, one of the things that killed everybody were wild animals. So it was really a rigorous place in which to live. You had to be able to defend yourself from wild animals, which would attack you. And, of course, they're frightened, just like the people are. And so they go into the caves where they can kind of defend themselves from the wild animals who are also driven into the mountains. So they know that this is Judgment Day. And apparently they had been told because they say, who can hide us from the wrath of the Lamb? Why is the Lamb mad? Because these are the people that didn't follow him. These are the people that committed murders and sins of all sorts. And so the Lamb is going to take vengeance upon the bad guys, because you recall that the righteous had asked about vengeance. And vengeance belongs to God. Okay, it does even now, although he, as we talked about last time, he allows governments to take vengeance on murderers as things are at the moment. All right. Remember now in verse 9 of chapter 5, you are worthy to take the scroll and open its seals. This is talking about when the Lamb was selected. Because you were slain, with your blood you purchased men of God from every tribe and language and people and nation. Did that include people before the flood? It really had to, didn't it? He was the Savior of all mankind, and somehow there was a relationship between Jesus, the Lamb, and the people of that day, even before the flood. And we see a hint of that in 1 Peter, the 3rd chapter. For Christ died for sins once and for all. It's talking about the same subject here, isn't it? The righteous for the unrighteous, to bring you to God. He was put to death in the body, but made alive by the Spirit. Through whom, through the Spirit, you see. Also, he went and preached to the spirits in prison who disobeyed long ago when God waited patiently in the days of Noah while the ark was being built. How long did it take Noah to build the ark? 100 years, a century. It was a slow and deliberate process, wasn't it? And he and his sons and perhaps some hired help built this huge ship over a long, long period of time. Well, who are these spirits in prison? And who's put them in prison? And why was he preaching to them? These are those who had disobeyed. So it's the descendants of Cain, by and large, although some of the descendants of Seth may have disobeyed too. But what kind of a prison were they in? Prison of sin. They had disobeyed. And he preached to them. Who do you suppose, it says, through the Holy Spirit. He was made alive by the Spirit, through whom he also went and preached to the spirits in prison. Well, for if God did not spare the ancient world when he brought forth the flood on its ungodly people, but protected Noah, a preacher of righteousness. So who was teaching them? Noah was. And I think the Lamb in the Spirit was perhaps in Noah. I don't know that Jesus appeared to them personally. He may have. It just doesn't say. But certainly through Noah's preaching, the Lamb was known to these people. Noah, a preacher of righteousness, was protected by God, even though there were millions and perhaps billions of the bad guys out after them. He and the seven others were protected by God in that period of time while Noah, Apparently Noah preached the whole 100 years while he was building the ark. And you would expect that. You would expect a righteous man to try to persuade others to follow God's instructions, wouldn't you? All right, now we get to chapter 7. After this, I saw four angels standing at the four corners of the earth, holding back the four winds of the earth to prevent any wind from blowing on the land or on the sea or on any tree. And this solved a problem for me. When I wrote the book about the flood, I was concerned about wind. If you have an atmosphere and an earth that's spinning once a day, every 24, 25 hours, we don't know exactly how fast it was spinning then, maybe a little faster than it does now. You have an atmosphere on this rotating sphere, and it tends to form wind. I mean, at the equator, the earth is traveling at 1,000 miles an hour. And you know, when you fly back from Europe at more northern latitudes, you can keep up with the sun at about 600 or 700 miles an hour. Doesn't go as fast. And at the pole, it isn't. It's just rotating. It's not going fast at all. So how do you not have wind? You have to have laminar flow. And if there were any wind, why would that destroy the land or the sea or the trees? Well, if there's a world without any wind, then there's a world without any rain. There's a world without any storms. And this is apparently the case. If you get wind, then you're going to get polar blasts moving down across the land like we have in the wintertime here in Houston even. And so you'd have cold and heat and summer and winter. But apparently that wasn't the case in that first world. And if there had been any wind, it would pick up the dust of the earth. The sea spray would make waves on the ocean, pick up the sea spray and nucleate the moisture in the air. And remember, the description back in Genesis is that there was a mist fell upon the land every night as the earth cooled. And so the earth's atmosphere is pretty well saturated. If there'd been any wind, pick up anything that could nucleate and form raindrops, then you'd have storms. So how did that work? Well, God had to station some angels to make sure there wasn't any wind. He did that artificially, you see. He did that by the four winds of the earth, in the north, east, south, and west. There wouldn't be any wind. They were all held back by angels. Then I saw another angel coming up from the east, having the seal of the living God. He called out in a loud voice to the four angels who had been given power to harm the land and the sea. So he's going to interact with the ones that are holding back the wind. Do not harm the land or the sea or the trees until we put a seal on the foreheads of the servants of our God. So if the wind had blown, it would harm, it would do damage to God's plan here. So this one angel is going to put a seal. Where's he going to put it? On the forehead. Why? What does that represent to you? If you're sealed on the forehead, and actually, if you're a Christian, you are. That's where your mind and heart is, isn't it? And so that represents something about your thinking and about who you are and what you represent. So I heard the number of those who were sealed, 144,000 from all the tribes of Israel. Wait, what? Where did Israel sneak into this? So here we have to, some, as we talked about before, we have some splaining to do at this point about Israel. You remember where the name Israel came from? That's right. We have Jacob wrestling with an angel, and he prevailed. And the man, this is the angel, said, "Your name will no longer be Jacob, but Israel, because you have struggled with God and with men and have done what? Overcome." Remember what was promised to those who overcome in the churches in the second and third chapters of Revelation? To him who overcomes, I will what? Give him a crown of life. Yeah. And every one of those end with something about the overcomers. If you overcome, you'll wear a white robe. If you overcome, you get a crown. If you overcome, so on. You can read through that list. So overcome. And the name Israel, words ending in E-L have to do with God. And I think the Israel term actually means struggled with God's help, perhaps, and have overcome. And so we're looking at people who've overcome. And if you skip over to the 14th chapter of Revelation, we'll get there maybe in about April. I looked, and there before me was the Lamb standing on Mount Zion, and with him 144,000. So you see, that's these same people who had his name and his father's name written on their foreheads. So when they were sealed, what was written on their foreheads? God's name and the Lamb's name, wasn't it? That means that they belong to God and they belong to the Lamb. So that's the 144,000. We can be pretty sure that they're the rescued, they're the redeemed from the first earth. And in Ephesians 4:30, do not grieve the Holy Spirit with whom you were sealed for the day of redemption. So that applies to everybody who's God's children. They are sealed in the foreheads, and you have been too. Okay, Cleo? The 144,000? Yeah, we're going to talk about that next, okay? Yeah, it's a specific number, isn't it? It's not rounded off, and we'll see how that goes. So here they are. From the tribe of Judah were sealed, how many? 12,000. And from the tribe of Reuben, 12,000. Tribe of Gad, 12,000. Asher, Naphtali, Manasseh, Simeon, Levi, Issachar, Zebulun, the tribe of Joseph, and the tribe of Benjamin, 12,000. There are 12 tribes times 12,000 is how many? 144,000. So John did his math. God did his math when he dictated this to John. So how did he wind up with exactly 12,000 in each of these cohorts of the redeemed? Two things that happened. We talked about it a little bit last week. God was timing the end when the flood would be sent so that the last person who died that was righteous was Methuselah. He was the 144,000th individual. And then the flood was sent. There weren't any righteous beyond that. So you see, he had been counting all along. But now, how did he get 12,000 in each of these tribes? They have to be arbitrarily assigned, don't you think? I don't think that you could get a population of millions and have exactly 12,000 in each one. So I think they were assigned for some reason to these separate groups. And why would God do something like that? Why would he want 12,000? Look at these lists. On the right is the list of the tribes of Israel listed in Numbers, the first chapter. And on the left is what's listed in Revelation 7, and they're not exactly alike. Notice that two new ones have been added on the left, Levi and Joseph, which are not tribes of fleshly Israel. And two on the right, Ephraim and Dan, are omitted from the list in Revelation 7. What's peculiar about Ephraim and Dan? Any of you know? Those were the two tribes that went totally into idolatry. Remember the story over in the book of Judges where these men came up and stole an idol from a Levite, and finally they took him with them and moved. They were the Danites, rejecting their assigned land in the south of Israel. The excuse was they couldn't dislodge the inhabitants there. So they all marched north and captured the city of Laish and turned it into the city of Dan. They slew all of its inhabitants, and they worshipped the idol that they had stolen from the Levite as they marched north. And so the Danites are all capitulated to Satan. They are all following idols. And Ephraim was a large tribe. Now, Dan was a very small tribe, but Ephraim is a very large tribe. And in fact, they were the dominant tribe of northern Israel in the divided kingdom. So, what did Ephraim do? Well, Ephraim and its kings followed the teachings of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who caused Israel to sin. And they worshiped, you remember the idols that Jeroboam set up? One in the north and one in the south, so that the people wouldn't go to Jerusalem to worship. So those two tribes, now this happens before in the story that John is being told, this happens before Israel actually existed. And so, but God knew how those 12 sons of Israel were going to be named, didn't he? And he probably told Jacob, who had a pretty good relationship with him after his name was changed, how to name his sons. Some of them had already been born. And so they were named, I'm sure, by God himself. But there were a couple of them, and it just points out that the individuals were free to sin. They were not predestined to do exactly what God said, and some of them rebelled, and they got excluded. So Joseph replaces Ephraim. Joseph was the father of both Ephraim and Manasseh, and in the original list, his two sons inherited in his place. And Dan, of course, is replaced by Levi. Why wasn't Levi in the list of 12 tribes? God was his inheritance, and they were God's inheritance. I'm sorry, I got it backwards. I guess it goes both ways. And they did not receive a land grant. Okay. So, now, why would God want 12,000 people assigned thousands of years, actually, before Israel actually existed? But they're in heaven, and they're going to do something, apparently, in connection with the 12 tribes of Israel. What do you suppose they might do? He might be using them in some way as observers. Do you remember what Paul said in Hebrews, the 12th chapter, the first verse, about we're surrounded by a great cloud of what? Witnesses. Who's watching you? Who's watching us? Somebody's watching. God has angels watching, I'm sure, but he may have assigned these 12,000. That's a pretty good crowd at a Rockets basketball game, isn't it? 12,000. I mean, it's not as many as you might expect. And after all, some of these tribes have hundreds of thousands of members over the period of existence. And maybe God has something for them to do. I've always thought that in heaven, the righteous are going to be given an assignment of some sort. We're going to have things to do. We're going to serve God as we do here on earth. Okay, we must move along. After this I looked, and there before me was a great multitude that no one could count. Now see, that's in contrast to the other multitude that was precisely counted, 144,000. But now we have a group that nobody could count. Well, why couldn't God count them? Think about that. From every nation, tribe, people, and language, standing before the throne and in front of the Lamb, they were wearing white robes. So what does that tell you? They're righteous. And were holding palm branches in their hands, and they cried out in a loud voice, "Salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb." Does that sound familiar, sort of? This part of the vision is something John actually had witnessed. Do you remember when? John 12. The next day, a great crowd that had come for the feast of Passover, heard that Jesus was on his way to Jerusalem. They took palm branches and went out to meet him, shouting, "Hosanna!" And Hosanna means what? Save, salvation. Yeah. "Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Blessed is the King of Israel." And so John thought that sounded familiar, I'm sure. And so that gave him a clue as to who these people were. Now all the angels were standing around the throne and around the elders and the four living creatures. They fell down on their faces before the throne and worshiped God, saying, Amen, praise and glory and wisdom and thanks and honor and power and strength be to our God forever and ever. Amen. And so this is an important event, seeing these this huge unnumbered crowd. And if it includes people that John had seen, you see it includes people who had, well, we're going to see some more about them in just a minute. People who had followed Jesus. Then one of the elders asked me, these in white robes, who are they and where did they come from? And I answered, sir, you know. I think he's begging the question. He's not real sure who this is. And he said, these are they who have come out of the great tribulation and have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. Who are they? They got to be Christians, don't they? Either they're Christians or they're people from the period before Christ came from Israel. And they were wearing white robes too. But predominantly this must be Christians, having made their robes white in the blood of the Lamb. Therefore, they are before the throne of God and serve him day and night in his temple. Where is his temple for the Christian? It's us, isn't it? It's individual body. Are these people in heaven or are they on earth? They're on earth. And we'll see that in a minute. They worship him day and night in his temple, and he who sits on the throne will spread his tent over them. Never again will they hunger, never again will they thirst. The sun will not beat upon them, nor any scorching heat. And these are all spiritual concepts that he's talking about here, because we get out in the sun, we get sunburned, don't we? For the Lamb at the center of the throne will be their shepherd. He will lead them to springs of living water. That sounds like Jesus, doesn't it? And God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. In heaven, there are no tears, right? I think that's what we believe. But they still have tears, but what does God do? Wipes, he comforts them, doesn't he? And so we're talking about Christians. Well, some of them had obeyed the gospel and by the time John wrote this. Some of them were living but not yet converted. Some were not yet born. So why is this a crowd that can't be numbered? Well, you can see why, because they're not all there, are they? There are going to be more added to it, and some of them who were there might rebel because they're still on earth and turn away, and they'll be deleted from the list. Jesus threatened some people in the second and third chapter of having their name erased from the book of life. You recall that? Now, when he opened the seventh seal, there was silence in heaven for about half an hour. That's a really remarkable verse, if you think about it. Two questions. Why was it silent? And is there time in heaven? Somebody had a stopwatch and said, half an hour. Is that time? There is time in heaven. You hear that some that somehow heaven is going to be a place where there's no time. But that's not the case. There is time. It seems to travel at a different rate than it does here on earth. Do you remember the comparison in two places? One in the 91st Psalm, or the 90th Psalm, I guess it is, and the other one in the third chapter of 2 Peter. A day with the Lord is as 1,000 years. 1,000 years is a day. Some people look at that and say, well, it goes both ways. No, I think he's saying the same thing twice, that 1,000 years on earth is about a day in heaven. And so how long is a half an hour? This is all conjecture. We're just guessing at this point. But if it's a 24-hour day, 25-hour day, then a half hour is about 20 years. You know, when he told the righteous who were asking for vengeance to wait a little while, it may have been a few days in heaven, and it would be 50 years or 500 years on earth. I don't know. But time's passing at different rates. And so that's kind of interesting. But why was there silence there? Well, the flood had come. What causes all the commotion in heaven normally? You see, there's no crisis. There's Noah and his 6-7 people with him on the ark for a while there. Do you suppose they're convinced to serve God faithfully and pray often and be careful about what they do and say? They're very firmly convinced that God's in control, aren't they? And so there's no crisis. And so there's nothing going on in heaven. They're not giving orders and receiving orders and angels being sent out to rescue this or that individual or something. It's all cared for. So for a short period of time, there's no commotion. And I saw the 7 angels who stand before God, and to them were given 7 trumpets. So he's going to come back to them in a minute. But then this other angel who had a golden censer came and stood at the altar. Now, it says he's an angel, but that all that says it's a messenger. It doesn't say whether he is a created angel or some other messenger, you see. So he's going to come and stand at the altar, and he was given much incense to offer with the prayers of all the saints, even if there's only 8 that are alive anymore. But this may be some further time down the road when there are more than 8, when some of the sons and daughters had been born to those 3 families of the sons of Noah. He was going to offer the incense and with the prayers of all the saints on the golden altar before the throne. And the smoke of the incense together with the prayers of the saints went up before God from the angel's hand. Then the angel took the censer, filled it with fire from the altar, and hurled it on the earth. And there came peals of thunder, rumblings, flashings of lightning, and an earthquake. Who do you suppose this is that's interceding for the people on earth? I think it's the Lamb. He's the ultimate messenger. He's not a created angel, but he serves the purpose of mediating between man and God. And throwing the censer with fire from the altar onto the earth signifies what? Transferring that power of mediation to whom? To man. And who was it that built an altar after the flood? Noah. And we don't read of any of the patriarchs being priests, you see. But now we will have priests on earth. Name some others that came along after Noah. We don't know all of them in the lineage, but there probably was a line of individuals. Melchizedek was one of these. They're not Jews. The Israelites have not been started yet. And we even find Jethro and Reuel later on interacting with Moses, and they're not Israelites either. And so there's a lineage of priests on the earth, and so this is given over to priests or high priests on earth to mediate between God and man. And I think that's what happened. Now that last phrase, there came peals of thunder, rumblings, flashings of lightning, and an earthquake, might remind you of an earlier verse. Oh, wait a minute. I hit the wrong one. There we go. Go back to Revelation 4 and 5, and you find from the throne there came flashes of lightning, rumblings, and peals of thunder. That's at the end of the creation, but before the Lamb was selected and before Adam went out. Now in Revelation 8, where we are, there came peals of thunder, rumblings, flashes of lightning, and an earthquake. And that's at the end of the flood. I think these verses are thrown into the text here as markers that represent changes in the way God administers his power on the earth. And we'll find another verse like this in chapter 11. There came flashes of lightning, rumblings, peals of thunder, an earthquake, and a great hailstorm. See what he does each time? What does he do? He adds one more item to it, doesn't he? As you go along. And that particular one in Revelation 11 occurs after the sacrifice of Jesus. So when there's a transition in the administration, then this verse is thrown in. And I don't know, it just caught my eye that there's something added every time. And you might look for the fourth one in there further on down as we go along. You'll find another case where there's a situation like this. Where the fifth item is added a verse or two later, it isn't added right at the same time. So that finishes the world before the flood. We've opened all of the seals on the scroll, and we're going to start now, as he pointed out, with some trumpet calls. Then the seven angels who had the seven trumpets prepared to sound them. And as you'll read in the handout I gave you, there are four of these that we'll look at tonight. And each one of them is preceded by a trumpet. What would a trumpet signify to you? If you could hear a trumpet, and in fact we're supposed to hear the trumpet of the Lord will sound. When is that? Well, I think time's going to continue, but that's, or time will be changed maybe or something. But the trumpet of the Lord, when who's coming? When Christ is coming. Okay. So it's a sound of a be alert, something's about to happen. Now I suspect with each trumpet, what this really turns out to be is a prophet on earth who warns people about idolatry. And that seems to be the case when we get down to the fifth one and the sixth one. We'll see that God is trying to alert people not to depend on idols. And he doesn't say that here, but it sounds like it's a warning. If you're going to serve idols, then you're going to suffer. And so the first angel sounded his trumpet, and there came fire and hail and fire mixed with blood, and it was hurled down upon the earth. A third of the earth was burned up. A third of the trees were burned up. All the green grass was burned up. You know, after the flood, mankind was very, very much afraid of storms. They had never had storms before. And this is a huge storm, isn't it? God sent a storm upon Egypt. Do you remember that? I think it's the ninth chapter of Exodus. Moses called the shot, said it's going to hail like you've never seen it before. And the Egyptians that believed him hurried to get all of their servants and cattle in the barn. But sure enough, it did. And it was used as a warning to the Egyptians about their idolatry and dependence upon idols for their protection. Second angel sounded his trumpet, and something like a huge mountain all ablaze was thrown into the sea. A third of the sea was turned into blood, and a third of the living creatures in the sea died, and a third of the ships were destroyed. I brought a book that I got a few years ago when it came out. Anybody know about Krakatoa? A huge mountain in Indonesia that blew up in 1883 and killed 40,000 people right away and sent a tsunami wave completely around the world. I mean, and that was small potatoes compared to what we're seeing here. A huge mountain, he says, thrown into the sea, blew up, all ablaze, thrown into the sea and would cause all of this devastation. The ships being destroyed would be because of the waves. Now, mankind had built ships by then, and this it didn't happen right after the flood. This is something that happened maybe 1,000 or 2,000 years later. Incidentally, I think the flood happened at 11,000 B.C. That's in my book, and you can see the reasons for that that I outlined in there. If any of you are interested, we can talk about that. But this is a couple of thousand years later. And it has this devastating effect, but apparently didn't change the idolaters from their course of rebellion. And so here's a volcano. This isn't Krakatoa, but give you an idea. Multiply that thing up many-fold. Incidentally, the largest volcano explosion that we know of was a mountain named Toba. Anybody know that story? It's supposed to be 40,000 years ago or something, but probably was within historic time. It may be the one that they're talking about. And it would have created what we would call a nuclear winter. It would have blotted out the sun and for a long period of time and caused the temperature to drop and do away with summer for several years in a row. So there have been a number of these explosions of island volcanoes that would do what was described in that. Now the next one is the formation of or the hitting of the Earth by an asteroid, and that one is named Wormwood. You can go visit this particular crater in southern Arizona near Winslow, Arizona. Has anybody ever been there? It's kind of interesting. It's over a mile wide and a half a mile deep. And it was formed by a little asteroid, probably 25 feet across. But it hits at such tremendous speeds that it's vaporized. And they dug in the bottom of this thing looking for it, thought if it was an iron meteorite, it would be worth millions of dollars. But they never found it because it was destroyed in the collision with the Earth. So the third angel sounded his trumpet, and a great star, blazing like a torch, fell from the sky on a third of the rivers and on the springs of water. The name of the star is Wormwood. Isn't that a neat name? A third of the waters turned bitter, and many people died from the waters that had become bitter. So when the asteroid hits the Earth, it vaporizes and scatters its contents over a wide range, hundreds of miles, in all directions. And this stuff that it's made of apparently was an alkali metal that turned all of the water bitter. That's, you've seen the stories and the shoot-em-ups about coming upon a pool of water out in the desert and it's bitter and they can't drink it because it's alkaline. And alkaline water is toxic. And so they didn't have any water to drink and the people died from the waters that had become bitter. And of course, the Israelites encountered pools of bitter water in their travels. The fourth angel sounded his trumpet, and a third of the sun was struck, a third of the moon, a third of the stars, so that a third of them turned dark, and the third of the day was without light, and also a third of the night. And when you read that, you think your first idea is the sun with a third of it blotted out. Well, in a way, that's right. In another way, all of you've lived through, at least the older ones of you, have lived through similar situations. Anybody from the 1930s and 40s experience a terrible dust storm? When the sun comes up, it's still dark. It has to get pretty far up above the layer of dust before you can even see it and before you have light on the Earth in the daytime. Same thing there. You can't see a lot of the weaker stars, and the moon was without third. It was also obliterated. Now, as I watched, I heard an eagle that was flying in midair call out in a loud voice, "Woe, woe, woe to the inhabitants of the earth because of the trumpet blast about to be sounded by the other three angels." So that's in chapter 9. And chapter 9 is a pivotal chapter that explains a whole lot about the New and Old Testament, as we will get to that next week. It's the origin of disease. Think about it. Men lived to be 800-900 years old. They had never get sick. God had created them in a way that they didn't contract disease. They had perfect immune systems. But now after the flood, and as time goes on, they're a bit more susceptible. And so Satan's going to take advantage of that. And he creates diseases administered by demons. And that is the connection between demons and disease that Jesus did away with in his ministry on earth. He countered that directly with his ministry. All right, that's the end. We timed that out just right.